Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Dispatch Live. My name is Mary Trimble, and I am the editor of the Morning Dispatch. Great to have you all joining us this evening. We have a great lineup for you. Later this evening, we'll be talking to the Dispatch politics crew, as well as John McCormick and the newest member, Charles Hillou. But first, we have a really exciting interview with Michael Weiss, the editor at The Insider, who just published a year-long investigative report into Havana Syndrome. So you may have seen that reporting on 60 Minutes on Sunday. And I think Der Spiegel is another one of your collaborators on this report. So we're excited to dive right in with Michael. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So I can imagine for our listeners and viewers tonight that it has been a while since Havana Syndrome has been front of mind for them. Mm-hmm. So let's just table set a little bit. What is Havana Syndrome? You know, when did we start hearing about these sort of anomalous health incidents, as they're called?
Yes, as they're called by the U.S. government. So Havana Syndrome is a set of symptoms which consist of vertigo, headaches, intense feelings of pressure in the head. There's a directionality to it, so people experience sometimes strange sounds, but only in one ear, and they feel like they're sort of caught in an energy beam when they first succumb or when they first experiencing this sort of phenomenon. But in some cases, in quite a few, and we've examined a lot of medical records, so we're not just taking it on faith of the testimonies of victims, they lead to long-term disabilities. So for instance, let me set the stage a little bit better here. It's called Havana Syndrome because the first cases started to arise and be publicized in 2017. But were recorded a year before in 2016 in Havana, Cuba, right? So the Obama administration famously has this rapprochement or a reset of diplomatic relations with the Castro regime in Cuba. The State Department returns, reopens the American embassy, and of course the CIA station also returns to Cuba. And all of a sudden, a lot of people, particularly in the CIA station, start to experience these symptoms. There's vestibular disorders. So people, you know, they get such intense vertigo that they can't even stand up or get out of bed. The headaches are so severe, they become like migraines. There's a brain fog, real cognitive disability. People cannot think straight. Some people experience expressive aphasia. They can't formulate words or sentences. And, you know, what's interesting about this is these are people who are kind of in the prime of their career, both as intelligence officers and as diplomats. And, you know, one of the counterarguments to Havana Syndrome, which is that it's just psychosomatic, is that people are inventing or manufacturing these symptoms spontaneously, maybe because they read about some weird stuff, you know, sound wave technology or microwave technology, or, you know, it's just mass hysteria. The problem with that is a lot of the people, and we know their backgrounds and some of their sort of operational history when we're talking about the CIA, have been through very intense environmental conditions, whether it's in the Middle East, in Iraq or Syria or Afghanistan or elsewhere around the globe, conflict environments, not ever diagnosed with PTSD. And all of a sudden, again, they experience a very common core characteristics, which are diagnosed later as being part of this phenomenon, right? And we look, the medical records all say mild traumatic brain injury, in some cases more severe medical conditions. Patient zero in Havana, a guy who's been all over the press, including recently on the back of our report, who goes by the pseudonym Adam. And I'm not giving anything away. Fox News posted a photo of him with CIA Director Mike Pompeo. So, he was in the CIA and he was in Havana. He is blind in one eye. He walks around with a weighted vest to this day. He was a case that was registered in 2016. So we're talking, you know, not quite a decade, but many years later. He can't walk, properly, because the weighted vest is to keep his balance steady. He will literally tip over without this thing. He's dysfunctional in the sense that he has no career, no job. He can't sit and focus, properly speaking, on a day-to-day basis to hold down a job. And in a strange, you know, tragic way, patient zero is sort of the embodied rebuttal to the idea that this is some sociogenic illness, which is to say, you know, everyone is just kind of inventing this in their head, and they're reading about Havana syndrome, so they're developing Havana syndrome, and it's all just kind of, you know, confabulated. This is a guy who, through the Havana Act, which the Biden administration passed in 2021, I think he was a GS-12 in CIA, so his salary would have been anywhere between like 120, maybe more than that. Havana Act paid him out like $100,000. And I've asked this guy repeatedly, would you give this money back to have your life back, to have your career back? Mm-hmm. You know, and I mean, without hesitation, he sort of laughs and says, this is a ridiculous question. I mean, my life is ruined because of this. So, and I bring this up because there are people who have suggested, and by the way, people in very high levels and former senior officials of the U.S. government, including in the intelligence community, who have suggested sotto voce to journalists such as myself that all of these victims are simply grifters, mm-hmm. want to pay out. They're manufacturing these symptoms simply to either sue the government or to lobby the government into passing the Havana Act so they can just cash in. It sounds ridiculous to me. And we've only looked into a very small subset of victims. And as I say, there are thousands of people who claim, oh, I must have Havana syndrome, and, you know, have come forward largely because the CIA at one point put out this kind of open casting call. Do you suffer from X, Y, and Z? So naturally, you're going to get a lot of false positives and people who are actually experiencing, you know, some kind of psychosomatic symptoms or who may be cranks. But the cases we have examined at The Insider and at 60 Minutes, we have examined medical records. We have talked to physicians. They all agree something is going on here. These people have legitimate medical problems that they did not have before the onset of their symptoms. And it's very bizarre that there's a kind of consistency here. So there was a report released in September of 2022. I linked to it twice in the Insider story because, unfortunately, the report was classified at the time. The executive summary was put out for agency bureaucratic reasons, but the whole report is worth reading. And it was obtained through Mark's aid, an attorney who's representing dozens of Havana syndrome victims through a Freedom of Information Act. It's heavily redacted, but actually what wasn't redacted is quite interesting. And this is a report that relies on classified intelligence. It's a team of scientists ranging from microbiologist David Relman, who's a co-chair of the panel, to physicists, to biologists, to psychiatrists, you name it. And their conclusion was, this is by no means psychosomatic, and these symptoms, this syndrome, can only be explained by some environmental factors or some external factors. Mm-hmm. And the report itself, the remit of the report, was to try and explain what are the plausible kinds of technologies, weapons, or you know, external conditions that could have created this. And the two that the report tends to focus on as plausible explanations are sound wave technology, which is to say acoustic sound, particularly ultrasound, they believe could cause some of these symptoms. Pulse microwave radiation. There's in the report, there's a chart that lists sort of the hypotheses. Pulse microwave radiation, strong fields in particular, the size of the pulse, the intensity of the pulse, they have hypothesized could compromise the blood-brain barrier, which is one of the kind of markers or the ways that Havana syndrome is diagnosed. So in other words, pulse microwave radiation can create an acute or traumatic brain incident such that proteins in the brain literally leak first into the spinal fluid and then eventually into the bloodstream. And you can test for these proteins. They're called biomarkers. And if you see biomarkers in somebody who was hitherto quite healthy and had their blood drawn and didn't have them, it's the sign that something bad has happened to them. They've suffered some kind of traumatic injury. And some of the controversy about Havana syndrome is, well, we don't have enough patients with biomarkers. But, you know, again, the conditions are such that you have to have somebody who's had their blood drawn prior to an attack, and then almost within 24 hours after an attack, because the body ends up metabolizing these proteins. One of the signature cases of Havana syndrome was the incoming chief of station of the CIA in Hanoi, Vietnam. And he was hit in 2021. He was living in temporary housing. I think we even named the hotel in our report because it was lockdown conditions because of COVID. And this is somebody who had blood drawn before and after, fit as a fiddle, marathon runner in prime physical health. And after his attack, lo and behold, he had these biomarkers. So, you know, again, these are not elderly people. These are not infirm people. These are not people with a history of any kind of psychiatric disorders. If they had PTSD, some of them, obviously, you know, the U.S. Army and armed forces tends to be a feeder into the CIA. If they had any kind of post-traumatic stress, it never registered like this, right? So I recommend everybody read the redacted and FOIA'd and now unclassified IC experts panel report, because it really goes into the science behind Havana syndrome. And we interviewed David Relman, the co-chair of this, extensively for our investigation. And, you know, one of the things he says is part of the controversy is people suggest this can't have been a real thing because it doesn't show up on MRIs. Nobody has brain damage. But they precisely say in this report the kind of after effects of these attacks will not show up on brain sort of imaging or scans like that. You have to test it. You have to look for it in a different manner.
Yeah. So for our listeners and viewers, we are linking this report in our chat, so you can read that when we're finished here. I would also just say, viewers, if you have questions, please also put them there, and our producer Victoria will feed them to me. So I want to back up a little bit, because mm-hmm. you've talked a lot about what Havana syndrome is, which is useful, but you've used the word hit, attack. So as you said, this is something, you know, theoretically, that is in environmental factors. Talk to me about Joy, who you mentioned in your article, someone who had the symptoms of Savanna syndrome, and how that connected you to what you think may be going on here in terms of the cause.
Right. So Joy, which is a pseudonym, she was the wife of a Department of Justice attaché attached to the U.S. Embassy in Tbilisi, Georgia. By the way, she's a nurse practitioner who had just got her PhD in anesthesiology. So she is a trained medical professional. Again, no history of any kind of significant medical precondition. One day she's doing laundry in her house, and they lived in a fairly upscale suburban community in Tbilisi, Dikhomi. And she suddenly started to experience a lot of the symptoms that are consistent with Havana syndrome. An intense pressure in the head, directionality. So I believe it was her left ear. She felt this acute ringing sound. She likens it on 60 Minutes to the sound a protagonist in a kind of action thriller might hear if a big bomb goes off, you know, that kind of ringing where the audience is meant to be literally inhabiting inside the head of the protagonist. And then she ran into the bathroom in adjoining the master bedroom of the house and projectile vomited, right? Nothing, there was no sort of buildup or accruing symptoms whatsoever. Suddenly, you know, in the middle of taking out a load of dry clothes from her dryer, she experienced this. Now, because she's the wife of a DOJ official, she had undergone overseas, you know, hazard training. And she knew to memorialize the circumstances of what happened. If anything untoward or seemingly violent occurs to an American official or their family members abroad, write down everything that you experience and try to, you know, take the measure of your surroundings. She checked the camera footage outside the house. Nothing was there. She opened the door of her house. She goes outside, and she sees a guy who is uncharacteristically tall for Georgia. I don't know if your viewers have ever been. Not exactly NBA material, the people of this country, right? This guy is about 6'2", 6'3", lanky blonde hair, and he's getting into a Mercedes crossover. So she clocks this guy, and she reaches in to get her iPhone out to take a photo of him, and he knows what she's doing. He's looking her dead in the eye. And he gets into the car and drives away, and she takes a photo of the license plate. So throughout the course of our investigation, and this has been a year, we were given to believe that if this was indeed, or these incidents were indeed connected in any way to Russia and the Russian intelligence services, the specific unit that we'd be looking at would be GRU Unit 29155. And this is very important to understand. This is the unit that was responsible for poisoning Sergei and Yulia Skripal in Salisbury with Novichok, the military-grade nerve agent. This is the unit that was responsible for poisoning Emilian Gebrev, a Bulgarian arms dealer, several years before in 2015 in Sofia. They poisoned him. They poisoned his factory manager. They poisoned his son. Emilian Gebrev, by the way, happens to be one of the few, at the time, European arms manufacturer who was selling ammunition to Georgia and Ukraine. They blew up Emilian Gebrev's ammunition depots all across Bulgaria with explosives. We've proven this at the Insider. They orchestrated an abortive coup in Montenegro on the eve of that country's accession to NATO. They've done a host of kinetic operations abroad. My colleague, Christo Grozev, formerly of Bellingcat, now the lead investigator at the Insider, this guy literally exposed the existence of 29155 and then anatomized all of their members. I wish I could speak to you for 2 hours about our methodology, but suffice it to say, it's all available, Bellingcat, Insider. You can Google this, how we do the work that we do. And this is a unit that consists of between 40 and 50 members. It's headed by a guy called Andrei Avryanov. Andrei Avryanov is now the deputy director of the GRU. He has also inherited the entire portfolio of Russia's foreign policy and all of the corruption and you know, sort of dividends that accrue therefrom in Africa since the assassination of Yevgeny Prigozhin, the oligarch who founded the Wagner Group and was almost certainly killed by Putin, most likely, by the way, killed by Avryanov himself. Mm. So Avryanov Senior is a very high-ranking official in the GRU, and he is the commander, the founding commander of Unit 29155. We showed a photograph to Joy of Avryanov's son, Albert Avryanov, who is in his 20s and was in his even earlier 20s in 2021 when Joy experienced these symptoms, and who we knew to be a new member of 29155, groomed since he's 16 years old by his father to inherit his father's job to be the commander of this unit. Russia, notoriously nepotistic as well as corrupt. She looked at this photo and had a, quote, visceral reaction. Again, she had already identified someone who was very tall getting into a Mercedes. She said, that looks exactly like the guy that I saw outside my house after I was hit. Very interesting. Two U.S. government officials told us Albert Avryanov was in Tbilisi, Georgia at the time of not only her attack, but other attacks that took place in that city. In the course of our investigation, we were able to geolocate Albert Avryanov flying to Tashkent, Uzbekistan, with his father, turning off his cell phone for exactly the period of time that he might have been in Georgia, and then turning on his cell phone immediately after the hits were concluded in Georgia, right? So the way that 29155 works, as any good spy organization with proper tradecraft would, is they don't fly directly to a destination. They use decoy destinations. They try to throw off any kind of counterintelligence that might be trailing their travel patterns. So that was interesting. We didn't expect to get a positive ID of an actual member of 29155 in our investigation. Later in the investigation, we learned that, by the way, Havana syndrome is exactly misnamed because even though publicly and in the international reporting, the first cases might have been noticed in Cuba, in fact, there was earlier cases. And one of those earlier cases was in November 2014, in Frankfurt, Germany. And staffers in the U.S. consulate in Frankfurt experienced these exact same symptoms. We spoke to one of these government employees I'm calling this person Taylor, and I'm going to use they, not because they are gender neutral in their pronouns, but because they choose not to have their gender revealed, because that might narrow down who they are. They're still in government service. So I'll let your listeners divine from that what they will. This person, who's very well trained in noticing details and people, remembers confronting a guy, a big, bulky, military-looking guy, outside of U.S. consulate housing in Frankfurt in about sometime in October 2014, going up to this guy, confronting him, and saying, "What are you doing?" Because this person, Taylor, noticed that he was clocking diplomatic plates on vehicles. And he muttered something in Russian and then skulked off. So she filed, sorry, they filed this away. I already screwed up. Too many little, you know, anonymities to keep track of here. But anyway, I think I've done this before in media, so they won't kill me. Several weeks later, is hit so badly in the U.S. consulate. Again, same kind of symptoms, directionality, feels like they're in an energy beam. Hit so badly, knocked unconscious, found in the bathroom of the U.S. consulate, and then wakes up in hospital, diagnosed with, you know, traumatic brain injury, vestibular disorder. Again, ticking all of the boxes of what will later be known as Havana syndrome. Showed Taylor a photo of a guy called Yegor Gorienko, who we had identified and geolocated as having traveled to Germany quite a bit in 2014, including with pit stops in Frankfurt. That's him. I'm getting goosebumps looking exactly at this photograph, mm-hmm. right? Even less hesitation than joy. So mm-hmm. here's a case in which two different eyewitnesses separated by, 8 years and over 1,000 miles apart geographically, they don't know of the existence of each other. Right? You know, one of the arguments that this is a sociogenic illness, maybe the victims are coordinating, they're talking to each other through suggestibility, they're being influenced by each other's stories. These people had no awareness that either one exists. Both identifying members, again, of a GRU unit whose remit is to do, up until now, as we know, three things. Mm-hmm. Assassination, sabotage, and insurrection. Kinetic, violent military activities. So, you know, one of the arguments the U.S. government has made, and this kind of eked out in the reporting about Havana syndrome in the last few years, is, well, yes, you know, we've managed to locate GRU registered vehicles to kind of the vicinities or the cities of where attacks took place. But hey, you know, the Russians are chock-a-block throughout Europe. They could just be there to do espionage. Unit 29155 does not do pure espionage. If they're reconnoitering a target, it's because that target has been selected for elimination. Or in this case, the closest thing to it, mm-hmm. being maimed to the point of disability, if not medical retirement, right? So we've put the pieces of this puzzle together. We've also found, because people say, well, okay, you know, even if the Russians can be located in the same general areas, how do we know that they're mucking about with any kind of device or weapon that could cause Havana syndrome? Well, funny you should ask. There's a lot of open source material that people can research about. In fact, today I saw an article in Sputnik where the then Russian defense minister, Anatoly Serdukov, in 2012 announced that by 2020 there will be a host of new kinds of weapons developed by the Russian Federation, including directed energy and wave technology weapons. I mean, literally saying what they're toying around with. But in our investigation, we managed to obtain classified documents showing, going back to the Soviet period, 1986, the Soviets created an institute in Kharkiv, Ukraine, that was dedicated to, among other things, experimentation with pulse microwave radiation. They called this Operation Reductor, or Gearbox. They put together a unit or a cell or just a team of researchers consisting of biologists, psychiatrists, you name it, engineers. They played around with zapping at first rats, monkeys, with microwave radiation to see if it would have any effect on their behavior and also see what the physiological effects would be on the biology of these creatures. Some of the animals in the labs were killed because they cranked it up too high. Some of them developed, brain injuries. All of this technology, according to the classified documents we obtained, were ferreted by the KGB back to Moscow in 1991, which is interesting because the Soviet Union collapses in 1991 and Ukraine gains its independence. We also have another set of documents from 2010, which suggests the Russians were toying with acoustic, particularly ultrasound technology. And they had found, and this is interesting, that to create the kinds of effects they were looking for, these debilitating disorders, ultrasound emitting devices would only have a range of about 10 to 12 meters. So the limitation with this technology is distance, right? You have to get up pretty close to somebody and hit them, and it enters into the ear, and that's how it affects, you know, the human biology. And that range is actually quite consistent with the U.S. intelligence community expert panel report on ultrasound technology. So we then found, and this is just, I know this is kind of lengthy, but it's a 10,000 word investigation, so forgive me if I'm going on a bit. We found a document that was uploaded by a member of 29155, actually by his aide-de-camp, who's another member of 29155. So this is a funny story. The joke in The Insider is everyone's afraid of the GRU, but the GRU is terrified of Tatiana from accounting. So why I say this, a guy called Colonel Terentiev, who's not just a Russian assassin and saboteur, but a trained engineer, and who moonlights as doing research for the Russian Ministry of Defense. We noticed he was getting promoted to a pretty plum gig as the federal inspector of a region in the far east of Russia, where the natural resources are aplenty. He was literally being promoted to Vladimir Putin's personal envoy. And as such, he had to be vetted by the Kremlin. Believe it or not, even to this day, the Kremlin has an anti-corruption office where they want to check where you made all your money and stuff. Mm-hmm. And Tatiana from accounting said, what is this disbursement in your checking account for money that we can't account for? And he said, again, his aide-de-camp was doing all the email for him. Oh, don't worry. That was just for a research project Terentiev did at MOD. What's the research project? Well, I can't really get into it. And she was persistent. So eventually they had to upload an addendum of the research project, which was into the potentialities for using non-lethal acoustic weapons in the context of an urban warfare environment. Mm-hmm. I mean, as good as a receipt of what they were playing with as you're likely to find. And I believe this year was like 2017. So clearly Terentiev and 29155 was experimenting with this stuff, looking into it, doing R&D on it in the years before. And this actually tracks now with what I mentioned about Serdukov, because if there was a competition, who can develop these weapons, it would have matched the time frame. So we're not saying we have solved the case. We are not saying we have the picture of the device, the technical specifications, this is what they're doing. We don't have video or photograph of Albert Avrianov or his dad or other members of 29155 pulling the trigger of something. But this is pretty compelling stuff. And I can tell you, it's been about, 48 hours, maybe 72 since the story broke. This has caused shockwaves in the intelligence community.
Yeah,
and in the White House. And there are people in very high positions of the U.S. government who are like, why didn't we know any of this? One of the things we're digging into is, how did the CIA go about its investigation into Havana syndrome, the GHIC team that was put together to look into this? Did they see 29155 in these places? Did they bring in victims of Havana syndrome and show them photographs as we did to say, did you notice anybody like this clocking your area and looking for possible targets? I mean, there's a lot of questions this raises, but I can tell you, we were surprised at some of the, I mean, unreported and private responses we're getting, including from inside the CIA now, about the detail and the granularity of what we uncovered. Yeah. And we're journalists with not very big resources, I might add. I mean, Christo is, you know, I've been working with him for a short period of time, but he's actually a subject in my book, which is about the GRU. That's how I met him. And I mean, he's a proper genius at what he does. And there are a few people I've ever met who can kind of have this mind palace Sherlockian capability that he does. But he's a Bulgarian investigative reporter who sits at a laptop and pulls this data. we don't have the budget, the resources, or the manpower of the collective U.S. intelligence community. And again, I mean, if this stuff was known, I'm surprised it hadn't leaked to the press, because yeah. most things tend to do. And I can tell you some of the reactions we're getting are, we had no idea, which is terrifying.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because, and I want to bring in a question from Brent Hall, which you may or may not be able to answer, but he wants to know if the U.S. government, if you know if the U.S. government has some sort of similar weapon. Is there evidence that you've seen that the U.S. government has experimented with this kind of technology? And as Brent points out, not necessarily to retaliate, but that would bolster the credibility of the story that the Russians have this too.
Yeah. So one of our working hypotheses, I should add, by the way, I kind of came into this a little bit blind, actually a lot of it blind, and I had no dog in the fight. I didn't know if Havana syndrome was real. We were actually, believe it or not, quite skeptical that 29155 would be doing this, because again, as much as we've uncovered about this unit and its brazenness throughout the years, and we work retroactively, right? Our last big investigation into these guys was about 2011, blowing up a Bulgarian ammunition depot. This is, what, 3 years before the invasion of Ukraine. It's in the midst of the Obama-Russian reset. So you have an act of terrorism on NATO-EU soil in the midst of rapprochement of some kind with Russia. So as much as we're almost, we sense we're incapable of being surprised by 29155, we would not attribute to them necessarily the willingness and the reality of attacking Americans. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking high value targets here, you know, senior officials in the CIA and the State Department. And another kind of interesting pattern here is a lot of these guys, a lot of the victims are Russia subject matter experts or subject matter experts in the former Soviet Union, Warsaw Pact nations, where Russia has a strategic interest in seeing them not outside of the Western orbit. Now, one of the things that we thought of was, well, what if Havana syndrome is actually caused by some technology the Americans are using, either for surveillance, eavesdropping, whatever, and this is a horrible side effect, and the government is like, well, you know, we know this, and how do we reconcile this? So let's conduct an investigation and exhaust all our resources and then say, we came up empty, but the victim's suffering is real, so let's pay them out. Mm-hmm. I mean, we hear a lot of rumors, and I mean, I have no doubt DOD has been tinkering with these kinds of devices. Have they been weaponizing them, though? Have they been deploying them? There's a lot of unknowns, right? I mean, I want to be clear. We're providing what we've uncovered. We're mm-hmm. not saying this is conclusive. The article is written in such a way, I hope nobody comes away thinking case closed, right? Mm-hmm. We're providing a collection of evidence, which at the very least, I mean, my benchmark for judging this is, if I take this to an intelligence agency, what we've written and what we've uncovered, is their response going to be, nothing to see here, move on? Or is their response going to be, you know, holy shit, like we need to look into this further. Mm-hmm. And it's been unanimous, because we have done that. We have showed it to, you know, former intelligence officers, unanimous that this merits further digging, and that all of the people that we have identified ought to be, like, not just their current activities, but retroactively all the things they got up to in prior years have to be completely interrogated anew.
Yeah. And I want to start to wrap up here, but I guess one of my last questions would be just, you've talked about sort of the private reaction from the U.S. government, the intelligence community. Mm-hmm. What has the public reaction been throughout this entire saga over the last 7 or so years that Havana syndrome has been public? What's been the official U.S. government line on this? And do you sense that will change?
So it's very paradoxical, right? The ODNI, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, came out in 2023, almost a year ago to this very day, with an assessment that said all of the collective intelligence agencies of the U.S. government, of which there are more than most people are aware, right? It's not just CIA, FBI, NSA, and the Defense Intelligence Agency, that we find it very unlikely, quote unquote, that a foreign adversary is responsible for anomalous health incidents. Except if you drill into that assessment, there's disparities between and amongst the multifarious intelligence agencies about their confidence in that assessment. On 60 Minutes, I hope all of you watched the segment. It was really quite well done. There was a guy called Greg Edgreen. Greg Edgreen is a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army. He was the head investigator into AHI for the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is the
adverse health incidents, which is
Havana syndrome.
Yes.
ironically enough, Greg Edgreen works for the American equivalent of the GRU. Mm. Greg said, and I was in D.C. for the shooting of this segment. This was many, many months ago, almost 8 months ago. And I was expecting, you know, this is a former government official. He's now retired in private life, actually has an organization that helps victims of Havana syndrome. I was expecting a very ambiguous and cagey bureaucratese styled answer. Mm. And he literally says on camera, it's the Russians. If it's not the Russians, I'll come back on the show and eat my tie. Mm. So categorical as to really make you think. And Greg had access to classified. He's one of five key investigators in the IC into AHI. So we know DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, didn't really jibe with this very unlikely assessment. The NSA, the National Security Agency, also did not jibe as well, we are told, we have reported, with this assessment. And that's very interesting, because what does the NSA do? Signals intelligence. They collect documents. They need to see things in black and white. They don't go out and recruit spies who tell them something, and they rely on the testimony of these people and the credibility of these people. If they don't have it there in their hands, it doesn't exist. So that's kind of interesting. And also, we understand the FBI, because their remit when it comes to Russia is counterintelligence. They are much more bullish on the idea that the Russians are behind this. So CIA, what's interesting, and I'll give you a little bit kind of the internal dynamics, which we're still kind of figuring out here, but I think I know enough now. Here's a quote, and I want people to really take this, memorize this quote, because I think it'll come back in interesting ways. There is not a single person in the Directorate of Operations. So this is where all the field operatives and officers who get stationed under diplomatic cover and embassies abroad go out and do the kind of cloak and dagger James Bond stuff, recruit agents and assets. There's not a single person in the Directorate of Operations who doesn't know someone who's affected by Havana syndrome, or who themselves or their family members have not been affected by Havana syndrome. Okay, that's how rife this thing is. Now, are they all inventing it? Is this some kind of sociogenic illness? Again, people in the DO, these are the badasses of American espionage, right? They're not snowflakes. They don't wilt under pressure so easily. Mm. There's a problem with the way the analysis and the investigation was done. I don't know how politicized it is. I don't know who the personalities are and the vested interests, but I can tell you internally within the agency, there is a great, great deal of discontent. And so much so that I'm finding out which stations abroad were lit up as a result of our report, mm-hmm. to the point where people in the field today are saying, how come we didn't know this?
Yeah.
Are we and our families in danger because these Russian saboteurs and assassins are coming to Europe to try and get us? Are they making it up? Are they being, you know, fantasists and hysterics? I find it very exceedingly unlikely. And by the way, I didn't emphasize this fact. I mean, I kind of alluded to it with respect to Joy in Tbilisi, because she is the wife of somebody who works for the U.S. government. She is not herself in the U.S. government, but family members have been affected by this. Mm. And not just spouses, but children, young children. There's a case of a guy who was in his car and his baby in the back seat started howling, screaming in agony, as he did himself, because they were simply, they found themselves again in this situation where, you know, almost like in an energy beam, this intense pressure, this horrific pain in their head, ringing in the ears, that kind of thing. So are the family members also making it up? You know, and one of the things people like to say is, well, this is all very suspicious, isn't it? Because it only affects Americans. Not true. Mm. Loads and loads of cases in Canada. Before I came on your show, I was on the phone with an attorney, a Canadian attorney who represents many victims in Canada who want to tell their story now. Yeah. So that's interesting too. But let's assume for the sake of argument, it was only Americans. the people who say this is psychosomatic or sociogenic, why is it only affecting Americans if they're inventing it? You know, if you're French or British or German, you've read about Havana syndrome. You know what the symptoms are. You might be influenced or you have susceptible to some suggestibility talking to your colleagues in the American government. How come they haven't experienced this? So you can kind of put the same rebuttal back to the people who are making this counter argument. But I don't know. I mean, I've interviewed the victims. And again, you know, you use your judgment. Do these people sound like fabulists? Do they sound like grifters or cynics or people looking? And knowing what I know about a lot of their case histories, I would be absolutely amazed if this is some kind of collective conspiracy, you know?
Yeah. Well, Michael, you have laid it out on the table for us. Lots of really interesting information. And I encourage all of our viewers to read your reporting, to watch the 60 Minutes segment. And we'll be looking for more of your reporting to come. Michael,
sure.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
So I'm going to bring in John McCormick and David Drucker now, who have been listening into this conversation. Before we jump into a hard reset with U.S. politics, any thoughts on the reporting we just heard from Michael Weiss?
I mean, it's just fantastic. I will admit that I've not followed the story closely, but I had followed it just enough to have been somewhat skeptical. I had known, you know, there had been the reports that were existing, but my first introduction to it was the 60 Minutes report, and they have the video of, you know, a police officer chasing down a Russian spy going, 100 and something miles an hour and having electronics equipment in his car. And, you know, all the details, the circumstances of, I think, just fantastic reporting and definitely merits a much, much more serious look than I think a lot of people had been giving it.
Yeah.
It's, it's really the stuff of a James Bond movie, which, but it's fascinating. And I just can't imagine there aren't going to be reverberations for our relationship with the Russians and how our intelligence agencies operate globally now that it's public. And I tend to wonder if the fact that we seem to know that it's the Russians that are behind this is why we've tried to downplay it and keep it so quiet. Mm. And there's so much more reporting I would imagine to come, or things we will find out, whether it takes months or years. But it makes me wonder if we don't want to give away sources and methods, or we don't want to have to escalate, because once this sort of thing becomes known, something has to be done about it, whether quietly or not. And there's so much going on globally right now for the government to handle. So anyway, it's just one of those things that when you hear it, it's different than assuming it.
Yeah. It's really fascinating. I'm sure we will be continuing to shoot Michael Weiss's articles around the Dispatch water cooler Slack. I want to jump to politics with the few minutes we have left here. David, I want to go to you first with some of your reporting on Michigan. You're heading there soon, I understand. To take a look at what the presidential contest there can tell us about the race more generally. Why is Michigan a good microcosm for looking at the race right now?
So to be honest with you, Mary, I don't know if Michigan's a microcosm necessarily. There are just so many cross currents there and plots that we can look at. I mean, number one, it's a battleground state, right? I mean, it's just one of those states that has become ultra competitive in the Trump era. Trump winning it narrowly in 16, Biden narrowly in 20, and Democrats had another good election there in 2022. But this is one of those blue wall states. And so you want to examine it from that perspective. And what we're trying to do on the politics team is hit a lot of these battleground states, battleground counties, look at big issues. And on the subject of big issues, Michigan is one of those states where Israel's war to eliminate Hamas in Gaza is playing a starring role, because there is a significant Middle Eastern population there. These are Americans, but both hailing from the Middle East, or their descent, or their descendants of people who immigrated from the Middle East. You have a Palestinian community, you have a Middle Eastern Christian community, and so there are particularly visceral opinions about what's going on in Gaza because of that. At the same time, and I think a lot of people miss this, there is a significant population of Americans of Jewish descent, or Jewish Americans, in suburban Detroit. Right now, they, you know, American Jews, by and large, vote for Democrats. But you can't take a vote for granted. You can't take votes for granted on an issue like this, especially with anti-Semitism raging around the country and around the world because of what happened in the aftermath of the Hamas massacre in southern Israel. And so taking a look at where Jews in and around Detroit are on this issue and their reaction to where Biden is. And this is an issue that continues to develop. I mean, just this evening, the president issued a statement about the accidental attack on aid workers that were a part of the Jose Andres food program. And it was a very harsh and strong statement. The president expressed outrage and said Israel can't make mistakes like this. They're not doing enough to protect humanitarian workers and allow aid to get into Palestinian civilians. At the same time, the president has continued to make sure that Israel has the weaponry that it needs to prosecute this war, even doing things outside, you know, even doing what he was able to do with his executive authority and existing munitions. Even though Congress hasn't been able to get its act together and pass an aid package that not only is supposed to include aid for Ukraine and Taiwan, but massive aid for Israel. So, you know, the president's sort of walking this tightrope in Michigan. And it's also a state where you have a lot of union workers. You have the auto industry. Trump was there just today in Grand Rapids, you know, talking about immigration, which is another issue of concern. It's all over the country, but it's there as well. So yeah. I'm headed to Michigan to try and take a look at all of this. I just, you know, it's like an embarrassment of riches when it comes to stories, and you know, we'll see what I get.
Yeah. Drucker, you're talking about an issue that's particularly tricky for Democrats, the Israel's war in Gaza. But John, you have been looking at a tricky political issue for Republicans with all of the abortion-related developments in Florida over really just 24 hours. So talk to us about what the last 24 hours have wrought for abortion policy in Florida.
Sure. On the policy matter, the Florida Supreme Court ruled 6-1 that the state constitution does not protect the right to abortion, that upheld the existing 15-week abortion limit that Ron DeSantis signed into law in 2022 that has been in effect for the past 2 years. That Supreme Court decision will now then trigger the Heartbeat Protection Act, which is effectively a 6 weeks of pregnancy limit on abortion, that it includes some exceptions, a 6 week ban. It has a rape exception till 15 weeks. It has a fatal fetal abnormality exception till the third trimester. It has a life and serious physical health exception throughout pregnancy for the mother. Obviously, big, you know, big matter policy. Florida's a big state. There are 80,000 abortions performed there in a typical year. Texas was something like 50,000. So this is, whether you're pro-life or pro-choice, obviously this is a big impact in a way, just in terms of the population of Florida. This brings Florida into alignment with Georgia's policy. Brian Kemp signed into a law, a similar heartbeat law. You know, he won re-election easily in 2022. But the big difference is that Georgia does not have referenda, and Florida does. Florida, you can add constitutional amendments by referendum. And what makes Florida different than a few of these other states that have it is that most of these other states, you pass a referendum, you can add an amendment to the state's constitution by a simple majority. Florida's different. Florida requires 60% support. Now, based on what's happened in other states so far, that could well happen. Michigan was something like, I forget exactly, it was like 56.6% to add an expansive right to abortion in the state constitution. This is now in November. We're talking about November. There's going to be a referendum. The Supreme Court also held they can go forward with this referendum. And so it'll take 60% of the vote to get there. And, you know, we haven't quite seen states like Michigan get to 60. It was, again, 56.6, 57, somewhere in there. But Florida is not quite maybe as socially conservative. So I think it's a real debate whether they'll get there. As for the politics, you know, you've heard a lot of people say, the Biden campaign says, Florida's now on the map. You know, I think you can make both arguments here. Now, I would point to, on one hand, go look at Kentucky. Kentucky had an abortion referendum on the ballot in 2022. It said there was no right to abortion in the state constitution. That failed by 5 points. It's not quite the same thing as adding a right to abortion, just saying there's no right to abortion in the state constitution. That failed by 5 points. At the same time, Rand Paul, who is sponsored, you know, I forget the exact title of it, it's one of these life at conception bills in Congress that many people say doesn't actually have an effect, but can be portrayed as being sweeping. He won re-election by 24 points. So, you know, will things go the same way in Florida in the fall that, you know, even if this this abortion referendum gets near or past that 60% threshold affecting this policy matter in a very big way. And so the Florida measure is basically saying that there would be a right to abortion for any reason up until viability, but really then there's abortion after viability for any reason that a quote unquote healthcare provider, which is not limited to doctors, says it's necessary to protect health, and health is not limited to physical health. So sweeping abortion policy versus a 6-week heartbeat bill. That's what's going to be up this fall. Based on what we've seen in other states, the sweeping abortion policies have had pretty strong popular support. If I want to compare Kentucky to another example, saying maybe there's actually something to this. Maybe they actually could improve their margin. I do think in Michigan in 2022, where there was a lot of money spent behind the abortion referendum, where it was because it's a purple state, you know, a swing state, I think there is evidence that Michigan, the turnout among Democrats was boosted. I don't have any great numbers exactly, but, you know, everything that I read at the time, it did seem that there was a big Democratic boost there. So that's basically the state of play on the policy and the politics.
Yeah. And John, you mentioned Michigan and the abortion politics in Michigan, which gives me the opportunity to bring Charles Hillow in, who is the newest member of the Dispatch. So welcome, Charles. I'll let you talk about yourself in a minute, but do you want to just chime in on some of the reporting that you did in your first week about how abortion politics are playing out in the Democratic Senate race, in the Senate race this year?
Well, absolutely. Thank you for having me on, Mary. And I realized as I was listening, it's interesting because this particular story dovetails very well with both John's story about being about abortion and what David was talking about being in Michigan, because this is a story about abortion at play in Michigan. And essentially, there's the Senate race that's going on this November, and it's looking like it's going to be between Republican Mike Rogers and Democrat Alyssa Slotkin. They're going to be fighting for the Senate race, and political operatives told me last week that it looks like abortion is going to be a big factor in that race, just as it was in 2022. As John mentioned, you had that rather expansive abortion referendum, and he was correct on the numbers. I can't remember the exact decimal place, but it was between 56% and 57%, so good memory. But as John said, that was credited with boosting Gretchen Whitmer and the other statewide Democrats who are running. And fast forward now to 2024, Democrats looks like they're going to be sort of ringing the same abortion bells as they did in 2022. And they're going to have a punching bag with Mike Rogers, who actually sponsored in 2013 one of these life at conception bills, which would declare a right to life from the moment of fertilization, essentially. And so, especially with the sort of controversies with IVF and Alabama and all of the political factors that are going on with there, Democrats do see an opening to perhaps repeat what they did in 2022 by really hitting Republicans hard on abortion. And they have perhaps a suitable person to do this for with Mike Rogers, who has a very strong pro-life record.
And has he stepped away from that record at all in the last few weeks?
He has in the past few months. He has said that he's not interested in pursuing any federal laws that would interfere with Proposal 3, which was this expansive abortion referendum. He's basically said that he doesn't want to put forth any federal laws that would interfere with the laws that Michigan has right now on the books, which, as John said, a very sweeping abortion right in the Constitution.
Yeah. It's interesting to me, John, you pointed out that the choice in Florida is not between, you know, a sort of milquetoast restriction versus a more lax law. Like these are the two extremes that Floridians are choosing from. Are there other examples of that we have seen? This sort of stark choice between sort of all or nothing, and what has the response been? You mentioned the sort of generally the more expansive laws are popular, but what is the precedent here?
Well, so Michigan was actually even more, because I believe Michigan at play there, I forget the exact details of what judges had said about it, but they had a pre-Roe abortion law that was throughout pregnancy. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, advocates of a right to abortion criticize heartbeat laws because they say many women, don't yet know they're pregnant at 6 weeks. But I forget the exact percentage, but something like 40 to 50% of abortions do occur before that point. So obviously, mm-hmm. It's not, all or nothing. And I think that's where, advocates of the unborn, pro-lifers would say, they think this is being, trying to strike some, balance there, saying there is some limited right very early in pregnancy, and thinking that this is politically sustainable. I think they've really kind of in Florida, they're really pushing, really pressing their luck about the prudence of it, whether, this thing could end up at 59%. It could end up at 62%. I don't know. Just generally, I think we've seen since Dobbs has occurred, you've seen, the side favoring a right to abortion succeeding basically everywhere, from Kansas to Montana to Michigan. I think there are a few reasons for that. I think that, just simply when you do have states that have bans on abortion throughout pregnancy with only an exception for the life of the mother, lacking exceptions for rape. I think that what happens in one state does affect people's perceptions in another state. I think the other huge thing, are these stories where care has been delayed in cases where even pro-life groups say, this is crazy. The law provides an exception for the life and physical health threats, serious physical health threats to the mother. And the elected officials in the pro-life states have not done a great job of countering what I believe, and I think it is correct, that that this is a false narrative, that these restrictions require delaying care in these circumstances. But these stories are, they're devastating. And everyone says, pro-life, pro-choice, this shouldn't be happening. And when it is happening, I think that really just does, cause a lot of people to say, well, I'll vote for the pro-choice side. I might have some qualms, but if it's all or nothing, I don't want this. So I do think that I think Ron DeSantis, if I were him, I would be directing every health agency to convey in clear terms as possible what this really means, highlighting what the exceptions mean. I said there are four different exceptions in the law.
Yeah. And it occurs to me, particularly in Florida, that there's sort of a Trump factor here. He has run afoul of the pro-life movement at several points over the last few months. Is he a factor at all either in Michigan or in Florida, to any of you really who have thoughts on how Trump will play in this conversation?
I'll just say, I don't want to hog the whole conversation, but I will say in Florida, I think that you're going to see a lot of TV ads quoting Donald Trump, calling the 6-week bill terrible. Remember when he was attacking Ron DeSantis, he called it terrible, too harsh. I think that's going to get a lot of play. And I think it's very conceivable that's worth a point or two or three. That could be the decisive factor in the race.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about Trump is that it's hard to tell what he's going to say and when he's going to say it. I mean, just in the past a week or so, if I'm getting my dates right, he started to lean into this idea that he'll support federal legislation banning abortion at some point of pregnancy nationally, right? And he's tried to frame it as Roe happened, the end of Roe happened because of me. The Dobbs decision is something I did. And it's me and me alone, which of course I'm sure a generation of conservative legal scholars and activists might have something to say about that, but that's fine. And then he's said that in fact, because I did this, now the pro-life community is in a strong negotiating position, and whether it's 6 weeks or 15 weeks or something else, it's going to be great. It's all going to be great. But what that does is give Democrats, who of course desperately want to tie Trump to the curtailment of abortion rights, something to chew on. And what's weird about this, I don't know if John thinks this is weird as I do, is that in the middle of the Republican primary, when you'd think that's when he wanted to lean into this, he didn't, and was openly critical of pro-life activists who were pushing for federal legislation and candidates who said they supported it. And now that all of that's done with, and he doesn't have to worry about the Republican nomination, now he decides to head the other direction. I just find that fascinating.
Well, we are 1 minute past 9 o'clock now. As is our way, we threw Charles right into the deep end. But welcome to the Dispatch. We're glad to have you. To our viewers, thanks so much for watching. Thanks, Michael, for joining us. Drucker McCormick, Charles, thanks so much for being with us. And good night, everyone.